Attention, KBOO listeners. Talking Earth and Colin Keating are on their way. You can donate to KBOO at bit.ly/KBOO. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on the FM dial. This is Talking Earth. I'm your host tonight, Patrick Bocard. And tonight I'm here with a young poet, Colin Keating. Colin Keating's writing has appeared in publications such as Gaptooth, The Oregon Voice, and People magazine. His Fugazi-themed sonnet cycle, Red Medicine, is that the title of it?
That's the title of the cycle, yeah.
Okay. Was selected for the Portland Poetry Press Week Summer 2016 Showcase. He lives in Oregon with a lot of projects in his mind. He also published the book I have in my hand, Dog Dao. I'm probably mispronouncing it.
You got it.
I got it? Okay. I used to take Tai Chi, and I should still be able to easily pronounce that, and I kept saying Dog Tao for a while.
That letter isn't that sound.
Yeah, but that's not how things work. But you are working on another book that is going to come out this year.
Yeah, and later this year. It's called Smoking at Disneyland.
Smoking at Disneyland.
Yeah.
Very appropriate. Yeah. We're going to discuss this book, have him read a couple poems, or several poems,
sure,
from Dog Dao, as well as the new one.
Yep.
So we will have some smoking at Disneyland. Did you want to read a poem?
Yeah, I'll start off with something. I can start off with something.
Yeah,
from the book,
go for it.
It's cool.
And you feel free to ignore my bookmarks.
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah, I've noticed everyone else's favorite poems are the ones I don't like.
Well, I think I did Black Metal Traffic Jam and Black Friday, but
yeah, oh yeah.
But I don't know if the other ones are the ones you would.
Oh, I really like this.
Go for it.
This one's called Teenage Murmurs Tour 2004. My virginity was taken when I made the earth a mixtape, and it never texted back. The night I lost my virginity may be the entire history of Western theological thought. They found mammoth bones under the OSU football field. All these people playing games above the dead. Learn to love skateboarding as a philosophical idea. It offers the poor transcendence, plus sick rail grinds. Yeah, revolution and all that. Just you and me whispering behind a black bandana, pronouncing IKEA names slowly, like they mean something.
I missed the mammoth bones when I first read that.
Yeah, I read that in a... it must have been 2020 or 2021 when I was putting the book together. These archaeologists discovered like mammoth bones and bones from like 12,000 years BC. And people had just, they had just packed the dirt and then put the AstroTurf on, and they were just playing football above it. The whole history from the time OSU was founded, they've been playing games over these dead bones. That was like one of those things I read it, and I say this a lot, but it's like there are a lot of things that are just already poems. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have to write about it. I'm like, oh, that's a poem right there. It's like, so I had to put it in the book somewhere. I was like, this is too interesting.
So like kind of, juxtaposing like a news article, something from the news article with like actual verse, you think?
I think it's more just the image of, I think we kind of forget that there's all this history before the idea of history, sort of, you know, and the mammoth bones and the football field, and I don't know. I like taking stuff from the real world a lot and putting it into my poems. And I think that's why people really dislike me or really like me, because I think there's this idea that poetry has to be this like timeless, transcendent sort of, you know, thing that doesn't talk about the 21st century or doesn't talk about modern stuff. I'm thinking about like poets I like Robert Frost or like Yeats.
You know? Okay.
But it's kind of part one of my projects and one of my aims when I write is to be like, does this feel like something that is from the 21st century that like is talking about stuff that I'd be interested in reading about? Is it not to be current, but like to use modern society and like put that together with the whole tradition, so to speak? That's really interesting to me. And I think poets have done that forever. Like Sylvia Plath does it, Whitman did it, you know, like the modernists, that was their whole jam, you know, so same with the postmodernists. It's like, I think that creates something really interesting, because if I have to read another poem about like walking through the woods and thinking about death, I'm gonna lose my mind. You know, you know what I mean?
It's been done.
It's been done to death. Yeah, it's been done. It's kind of like if you want to write a song about how you have to escape this small town forever. It's like Bruce Springsteen already exists. Like the boss is already there, and like good luck trying to improve on that. There's plenty of like, I've really come around on Mary Oliver, who I really didn't used to like. But her work is really solid. And there's exceptions where I'm like, okay, you're good. You know, like, this is cool. But a lot of times, especially with, like, younger poets, I've noticed that they're trying to emulate the poet. Obviously, they're trying to emulate the poets that they read and that they admire. But they're just kind of recycling their content, too. They're not taking the formal part of it and applying it to new content, you know? Like, you take the structure, you take the style, or you take the structure, but you have your own style, and you bring your own preoccupations, like what you're interested in writing about, you know? And like, it's like, nature's great, don't get me wrong, but it reminds me of a quote from Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec, where he's like, why would I want to look at a painting of nature when I can just go out in it, you know? And I obviously don't agree with everything he says on that show all the time, but that really struck me. I was like, that's kind of fair, you know? I was like, I want to read a poem about like a monster truck rally or like being on a dating app like that. I don't know, that can go really wrong, you know? Like, you can write a really cringy poem about that stuff, but when it's done right, it's like, mwah, love it.
But I mean, part of it is no one's actually, There is no poem that is the dating app poem.
Right, exactly. Yet. You know, like you have, I'm trying to think. You have, take for example, like take like Yeats's Alita and the Swan, right? Which just seems like that's a pretty cool riff on that myth. But no one kind of can point to be like, oh, that's the Tinder poem. And like, that's the poem I can use as my inspiration to write my dating app poem. Because people think it's beneath them to write that, because poetry is supposed to be this, like, you know, like, it's what happened to Shakespeare. It's like, this guy is making, like, sex jokes all the time, and it is high poetry, it's high art, but, like, you can do both, you know, like, and that's what's really fun about it. It's like, I challenge you to write a really gorgeous poem about something really ugly, you know, like, that, those poems are super cool to me. I'm like, oh, you did it. Now I'm, like, seeing this a different way.
So one of my inspirations back when I was, before I really was writing poetry very much, was this Lawrence Robb poem. I don't know, have you heard of him?
I have never read
him. So he wrote this poem called Attack of the Crab Monsters.
Oh no, I have read him. I read him in college.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
So
I love that poem.
Yes, and I proceeded to write a bunch of poems about, many of which were terrible.
Right, right.
But I did write a couple that were decent or good about, like, giant monster, a kaiju.
Sure, movies. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, none of them had as good a line as, like, you put down that flamethrower and you know
it's all sad. Yeah.
Which doesn't appear in the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So he needed to, you know, go somewhere else with the plot line.
Yeah.
But
yeah, see, that's, I'm trying to think of, there's a couple poets I really like that, especially for, like, Dog Dao, really inspired the book and kind of my, I would call it, like, my first style. With my second book, I'm kind of going into a second style, which I'm very excited about. But the first style, there's a book by this guy named Dan Madgers off of this Brooklyn publisher called Birds LLC, and he has a book called Party Knife. And it's just all of these free verse poems, untitled free verse poems, this kind of running narrative through it, kind of, but it's kind of has the same sort of like tactic of my book, which is like jokes, you know, like almost like memes. Like, here's a joke, here's something ironic, here's something silly, or now here's something serious, but we're gonna couch it in all this silly stuff. And I really like, I remember reading that in college and being like, this is how I want to write. Like, this is not, I was entertained by it, you know? And then there was another book by, oh my God, I think his pen name is Heiko Julian. And it's called, I'm going to butcher this, but it's, I'm No Longer Afraid to Die a Violent Death. And it's, okay, it's a similar kind of book. It's almost like tweets that are combined together, but the tweets are poems.
That's a very interesting idea, in that a tweet is, I mean, it's a little bit like a haiku.
Yeah.
It's not quite, but it's like you have to be that, only that many letters, I think.
Yeah, like, I think that's a interesting, like, new formalism, a new formal thing. It's like, it's got to be, what, 140 characters?
I'm not sure. I'm not on X.
I don't know, but it's like, it's sort of, it forces you to be concise. And especially if you're writing, I hate to call them joke poems, but I'd say poems with jokes in them, or poems that have humor in them as like a poetic tactic, that's really helpful. It's like boot camp. Like, Twitter's like writer boot camp in a way. It's like, I gotta be funny, and I gotta be funny in like three sentences, you know? Like, I love that stuff. But yeah, those two books were really, really inspiring to me. I mean, I love all kinds of other poets and all other kinds of writing.
But that author was...
His name's Heiko Julian.
Heiko Julian.
Yeah, he was part of sort of that like alt-lit crowd, if you know, like, what's the most famous, what's his name? He wrote Taipei. Oh my gosh, he's a Korean or Taiwanese writer. Tao Lin, if you know Tao Lin.
Actually, this is all flowing over my head. I'm going to be doing a lot of research after this.
Cool, yeah.
So that's kind of nice.
Tao Lin is cool. He's got this kind of like really detached... He's kind of like Bret Easton Ellis. And like, he's got this sort of detached style. Sort of ironic, but so detached you can't even tell if he's being ironic.
But it's sort of... It's poetry, not fiction?
He has books of poetry, but his fiction are... is what I'm really into. I mean, I take a lot of, with my poetry, I take a lot of inspiration from like fiction writers too. And there's all kinds of writing. I think it's all super interesting. And yeah, I mean, like the Attack of the Crab Monsters, that is a great poem. There's, it's a great poem by Alan Shapiro called Old Joke, which is like a parody of like old Greek like poems and like laudatory poems and odes like that. And I think I really like those poets who like have fun with the style, have fun with the content, but aren't like, they're not like Ogden Nash, you know what I mean? They're not like joke poets. It's not just a joke. Not to say like Ogden Nash has great stuff, but it's like his aim is to make you laugh. Whereas I think for me personally as a writer, it's like, in my personality as a person in general, it's like I just naturally, I don't want to say I'm naturally funny, wow, I'm so great, but like I naturally use humor to get through situations. I think a lot of people do, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I'm just trying to like ease this, you know, or make this better and get through this like thing without it being weird. And I think a lot of people take themselves really seriously. Poets especially take themselves really seriously. And it's nice to kind of be that sort of like weird scummy punk kid at the like soiree, you know what I mean? Like, I'm always the one crashing like a ballroom and just sort of being like, hey, you can still make sex jokes. And like, what happened to sex jokes in poetry? You know, I don't know. I like that role. I will gladly play it.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is that a lot of the earlier poems, they were also writing about ordinary things that nobody had written about before.
Right, yeah.
Like, Ode on a Grecian Urn is about a piece of pottery.
Yeah.
You know, but that is, nobody thinks about that anymore.
Right. You have Shakespeare's, his sonnets. He has a sonnet where it's the, you know, the medieval blazon, which is like, your eyes are as blue as the sky and your hair is as gold as the whatever, you know. Basically, you're trying to, you're basically love bombing somebody. So be like, hey, maybe we can hang out and like kiss and stuff. But he has that one song where he's like, my mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun, you know, and just insults this, his beloved, for these 14 lines. And then in the couplet, he kind of, at the end couplet, he's just like, but you're still mine, you know?
Yeah, he like pulls it back.
But you're my ugly person. So, you know, he pulls it back. Or yeah, you know, you had even like Robert Frost, lesser known stuff, some of his prosier stuff, like Talking to a Gentleman Farmer. No one had written that way before. Whitman is a huge touchstone for me because, like, he was, you know, writing about the working class and in his own sort of subtle way, or maybe not so subtle way, talking about, you know, queer men, you know, for the first time, at, like, out in the open in poetry. That's very important to me. But also just being like the lorry drivers, like the page boys, like the newspaper boys, like, you know, like nobody was writing about those people. Nobody cared, you know, like poetry was like for the nobility. And then you had sort of like the transcendentalists and the early modernists kind of coming in and being like, no, like all this stuff is interesting. All this stuff is worth writing about, you know.
Do you want to read another poem?
Sure, yeah.
Do you want to read a new one or do you want to read out of Talk Cow?
Let me read a new one. Let me see what I got in here. Okay, this one I wrote in March 2020, so right first couple weeks of lockdown.
Okay.
And I was just so bored, you know. like, and I'm just looking around and going outside with a mask, just like, this is so weird, man. Like, this is like the weirdest thing. So it's called New Plague. I was so bored. It is not enough to say the streets are empty, or that the buses drain of people, or that the sound of children fails to chime as the spring sun thaws the sky. Tanks roll through the streets of Italy, Germany is on full lockdown, and I bump into a friend at the grocery store. America, proud to live in a country where an ethic of rugged individualism can kill my own grandparents. Waving a stupid flag, waving my own stupid flag outside of my house, in my boxers, mock surrendering my slack jaw. Time doesn't exist anymore, one of my roommates says as she pours vodka at 10:30 in the morning. It is not enough to say that I'm worried about using drugs, but perhaps enough to consider them. A distorted reality is a necessity now. Yesterday, I slapped my face in the mirror to see if I could still feel. I meant it to be some kind of dramatic demonstration of numbness, set to a Nine Inch Nails song, maybe. It just aroused me. Capitalism is canceled, and sexual tension stocks are at an all-time high. Bless a horny plague. It is not enough to say that art will save us, or to construct drawn-out images and metaphors, motifs and symbols to sort of, you know, wind you through what I'm trying to say here. I don't think we have time for that now, or if my roommate is right, at all. Developing split personalities for shits and giggles. My other roommate came out to the backyard with a sledgehammer and asked if I wanted to smash a sink in our basement. I followed him down the flaked wooden steps, gripped the handle, and swung against the porcelain. It smashed to the ground, white mosaic, choir of dust. That was great, my roommate thumped my back. It felt good to break something, to see its jagged pieces, and know only I was to blame.
Kind of summed up the early...
A little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah. That last part actually happened.
Oh, yeah, I was assuming. I mean, so sometimes it doesn't happen in your poems? Like, it's not real
life?
Oh,
yeah, no. I feel like that's one of the big... That's like they really hammered that into me in college. They're like, the speaker is not the writer. Like, the speaker of your poem is different. Because if that were the case, then, like, all of us would have to be arrested, you know?
No, there's... I feel that, like, very often people just assume that...
It does happen. I kind of like that because I can play with that, too. So, you know, I'll write something where my speaker or my narrator or whoever does something just insane, you know, or says something really not PC or not, you know, not trying to be an edgelord, but you know what I mean? It's like... I think now people have a really hard time, like, if they don't have a protagonist they can root for, they're like, this is bad, and the writer believes this. It's like, no.
There's an assumption there, yes.
Absolutely. My friend Trace calls it the Harry Potter syndrome, of just, like, needing to like everybody you read about. Whereas, like, I don't know about you, but, like, I like reading... because it's about people I don't like a lot of. Those are the people that interest me the most, you know?
So that's more the Game of Thrones?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Or even, totally. Or just, like, Confederacy of Dunces, American Psycho. Like, you know, like, these are all characters. Obviously, you should not, you know. Yeah. People being like, this serial killer is bad. It's, like, beside the point. You know, it's like, yeah. You're not engaging with the ideas that the book is presenting to you because you're like, I don't like it. But when it comes to writing poems, it's like, people will be like, did that actually happen to you? Or that they'll assume that it happened to me. And then I get to be, like, so much cooler. Because, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just a way of elaborately lying. And then people just assume it. But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I have a weird... I mean, when I read Dante...
Right, yeah.
Because he has a much... different opinion of almost everything.
Oh, he's such a hater.
Yeah.
He hates everything.
Well, I mean, I don't know if he hates everything because I didn't get to Paradiso. I got through Purgatorio.
Purgatorio is interesting.
It is interesting. I just wasn't able to, like, I just stopped and then I didn't bother to...
Yeah. What'd you think of Dante? I mean, what did you think of Inferno?
Oh, I read it and I really enjoyed it, but yeah, it's very much, you're not, you know, yeah, you're not really, I mean, I was probably like 20 or something when I was reading it and I had a lot of free time.
Yeah.
You know, but like it was definitely, there's a lot of great images in there. It's a lot of, and I was reading the Italian and I don't know Italian, but it was John Ciano's translation.
That's the same translation I read.
Yeah, I think that's the big one. That, but like, yeah, it's. I mean, that kind of pulls you through, and
yeah.
You know, and but the thing is, there's a little bit of regret there, but most of it is like, yeah, these people completely deserve to be tortured forever. It means I don't like them.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, like, you hit the nail on the head.
Muhammad needs to get, you know, this horrible stuff done to him.
Yeah, it's like, or like a lot of it is like, you'll read it, it's like these obscure, like, 14th century Italian politicians. And he's covered in poop. Like, that's it. You know. Or I'm just going to set up. He's on fire forever. It's like the logic of like a 12-year-old.
He got turned into a twig. And
yeah.
Then you walk through and he's screaming.
Yeah, exactly. But he stops screaming enough to like go into like six verses of just. He's like, ah, oh, my hubris, you know, whatever. Like, it's like rappers have diss tracks and Dante has the Inferno.
Yes.
You
know?
Like, he goes in
there. I mean, even Purgatorio's kind of like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's you
like
know?
People he, like, hated on a lesser level are just like, you do deserve to be here. It's that smugness that kind of comes with medieval Catholicism, especially like the Italian type, which is like, oh no, you deserve to be.
It's kind of interesting reading that and then reading Machiavelli, because Machiavelli is like not kind of not of the same opinion.
No, yeah.
I mean the prince that everyone you know reads, because it's a short book.
Yeah.
If you actually are careful to read it, you understand that he's suggesting that this is how what you do if you're going to be you're not going to have a republic and you're going to run everything and that's how you have to do it, but you're better off living in a republic.
Yeah. I think Machiavelli, it's like instructions for amorality. It's like kind of, God forbid we get to this, but if like, might as well flesh out this idea.
Well, there was that, but it's also there's the discourses on the first 10 books of Titus Livius' History of Rome.
Yeah.
Which is about a republic. Because, and it's when Machiavelli was a diplomat for various republics until the Medicis took over and then tortured them.
Right.
Which everyone forgets about. And then, like, you read those, it's like all about how republics work or how the Roman Republic work and why it's more likely to survive, which is true.
Right. And history has borne that out, too.
Yeah, no, and it is kind of amoral in the sense he was just trying to write, like, this is how everything works, and Dante's like, oh, this is how everything should be, and I hate these people.
Yeah.
They should be tortured forever.
Yeah, I think they both are writing from a place of morality, but, like, Dante is coming from it with a righteousness that kind of, you know, obviously because of his religious... But, like, the thing I always forget about the Inferno is that he... literally created the blueprint of how we think of hell. You know,
yeah.
Like when somebody now says, like, oh yeah, there's a place for you in like the lowest circle of hell. That didn't exist before Inferno. He literally was so full of like pettiness and anger and hatred for these people. He's like, I have to construct a whole like architecture of suffering for people that I don't like. You know, like... I think my favorite part of Inferno is when you get down to actually get down to Lucifer, and it's not hot, it's cold, it's just ice.
And
it's
there's like, only three of them there, and he's chewing on the heads.
Yeah, he's chewing on the heads, and like there's Judas there. I do really like the idea that,
Oh, and the other thing that's interesting, comparing to Machiavelli would not have put Brutus... down on the bottom.
No, yeah.
He was of the opinion that Julius Caesar was corrupting the Republic.
Yeah, my partner and I recently saw Portland Center Stage is doing a production of Coriolanus, or Coriolanus, whatever
you're saying. I'm not sure how it's pronounced.
But, you know, are you familiar with that one?
I haven't read that one. I know it's a Shakespeare, and it's based on Rome. And
yeah, it's based on basically this Roman war hero who came back and he wants to be a consul, like a senator, basically. But he hates the modern people. Like, he just hates them. He hates the plebeians. And he's... Part of me, like, really relates to him because he's just like, you're all so stupid, you know? Like, and you're all da-da-da-da. But it's about hubris. It's the same with Julius Caesar. And people, you know, see, like... Brutus as being the ultimate in betrayal, and it's like Julius Caesar was a fascist. Like, he was
Know where the term fascist comes from, right?
Fasci, right?
Yeah, it's an earlier thing from Rome.
From Rome,
they
would
walk around with those
bundled sticks, using it to vote.
I wasn't sure exactly what they were. I thought they were like judging people or something.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think they bound the sticks and used it to whack people. I mean, that sounds about right.
Yeah, but it was like before. I think it might even have been before the Republican went into the Republic. But like, there were rules about it and stuff. But like, the term dictator comes from Rome, and it was originally just an office where you're voted in or elected to be a dictator by the Senate.
That's so funny. You know what I mean? What
you're doing is like you're basically a consul with stronger powers.
Yeah.
To deal with a crisis, and when the crisis
like
is over.
Yeah, yeah. Like
you
martial
stop.
Law. Yeah, that's what they talk about in Coriolanus too.
And then Julius Caesar decided to be dictator for life.
Right.
And now a dictator means something else completely different.
Exactly.
And is that Brutus's fault? Not really.
Not really. He was trying to save the Republic. Like,
yeah.
I think of Brutus as a hero. But yeah, no, like Brutus is down there along with Judas, which is kind of like...
Or someone else.
Yeah, there's someone else. I think it was... One of the ones is forsaking hospitality, which in like Roman
it might have been
Greek
another
culture,
it was another Roman
yeah somebody Italian. Who was like welcomed into a home and then like killed their the person who gave them hospitality, their host.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think now that I think about it, I think all three of them are Italian.
Yeah,
he's like a little bit biased there.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, there's no one in Africa or China ever, like, you know, there were no reason for them to get eaten.
Yeah, right, exactly. He's like, and it's not even like all of Europe. It's like all of Europe. I was like, by the 1300s, all kinds of horrible stuff had gone down, and not once was he like, maybe, you know,
well, put somebody from another country.
Yeah, now. He's like, I'm gonna keep this in house.
Oh man, how did we get on?
Talking about the Roman Empire is always gonna derail any.
Yeah, that's kind of that joke about like men.
Their Roman Empire, yeah, it's really true. People talk about it. I'm like, let's talk about the consul, you know. And people's like, here we go again.
Well, let's talk about the Punic Wars.
Yeah, right, exactly. Just like, did you? Yeah, I think that did remind me though of like a poem from this book. Let me see. Here we go. Yeah, just because it mentions Europe, I got this one. It's called 666.
Oh yeah,
money, money, money. It's always the same backyard and the same construction workers blasting hip hop on a Monday afternoon. But you're all right, backyard. He said it was a sativa blend. What do I care? Sleeping in till noon, stoned and starving. Hire me to piss in a cup. This place might slip from me and I wouldn't mind at all. You love the Belgian water skier in the back of the discotheque, somewhere far off in the future. You travel to Europe looking for that one transcendent moment everyone hopes for, a fantastic event to eclipse all else, so you can add another chapter to that white person epic, Europe Changed My Life. Ugh. I am a moon full of hope. I am a mattress on the floor. I kill myself sarcastically. Even if I'm not literally face down on the floor, I'm figuratively face down in my heart or whatever. And now a word from our sponsors.
I'm trying to remember that one. What you are currently not hearing now on the KBU airwaves is my cat Leo. It's a Siamese cat. He prefers to meow only when not being recorded. I wish I could record him in honor of International Pet Day or National Pet Day. But obviously, I can't force him to meow if he doesn't want to. That's Leo. That's Leo suggesting that you can donate to KBU at kboo.fm/give. He feels it's very urgent that you do so. And now he's going to play with his stuffed animals. Back to our show. You're listening to Talking Earth on KBL Portland, and you've been listening to Colin Keating and discussing the Roman Empire, Machiavelli, and mostly Dante and poetry, which is how Dante showed up, probably.
Yeah.
And that poem, that might have been the one that I was wondering. It's not Black Friday. There was one. No, it was Adventures with health benefits or Skynet.
Yeah.
I was wondering if the next page was part of the poem or not. Oh, I couldn't tell. Yeah, don't mind my bookmarks.
Oh, this one?
Yeah, is that
no,
a separate
no,
poem?
It's a separate one. It's kind of like anything that's in italics and doesn't have a title, those are usually taken from, and I carry this into the new book too. It's taken from a dream. I keep a really detailed dream journal. Most people are like, dreams are boring, but my dreams are not.
No, a lot of dreams are not. Dreams are usually not boring.
They're pretty fascinating. And yeah, that one about the player piano. I just love the abruptness of it, because, like, dreams do that thing where, like, there's no writer of your dream. It's just your subconscious, right? So it just ends whenever it wants.
When you wake up.
When you wake up, you know, like, you'll get interrupted all the time and, you know, whatever. So that section ends with them being like, this is a player piano. And the other guy goes, oh. And, like, then it just ends. I like how abrupt that is.
I wasn't sure if they didn't seem like there was a connection.
Yeah.
Was
I really like that crossed your mind, though.
Oh, I do, like...
I mean, the whole book is kind of like a fever dream.
Oh, that was the other thing. The reason I brought that up is 666 money. How do you put money, money, money?
I just say money, money, money. It's dollars. Or dollar sign is too clunky.
But I was wondering if Europe Changed My Life was another book. Oh, right. It's like the opposite there.
I think that, there's, I like the white person epic, Europe Changed My Life.
It's so true.
Like, just the, like, I just came back from Barcelona and it's amazing. I'm just, shut up. I know. I get it. Please go somewhere else.
Cool. So, you do have a bunch of formal poems in this in this book. Like, do you have any sonnets in it or not?
No, that was a conscious decision.
Yeah, but you do. You do have the sonnet cycle.
Yeah.
Space in Fugazi.
Yeah, well, I have my friend Jessica Wadley and her creative partner. They have this. What's up, Jessica? They have this imprint called Zines and Things, and they produce, like, zines from various authors, and they used to do this, like, monthly poetry or, like, writing booklet thing. So every month subscribers would get a little booklet, and it would be like 5 pages of a prose piece. For me, they did like 3 of my Fugazi poems, and I wrote those poems when I was in a mental hospital. And I was only allowed to listen to certain things on this iPod, and one of them was Fugazi. And I love Fugazi. So I was like, how can I incorporate lyrics into the lines of the sonnet? And I ended up writing 16 sonnets in there. And I tried it for so long in vain to get them published. I was like, I thought these were so cool, you know? But people either didn't like it, they didn't get it, that it was a little too heavy for them. But then the Poetry Press Week people, I submitted, you know, that's like you do a performance of the poems. And mine was a combination of someone reading it, an enactment of it, like in a play, and then a live band playing the instrumental version of the song that the poems are based on. So the song, like, Waiting Room, they'd be playing the instrumental version of Waiting Room in the back. And the people got the proposal and they were like, this is awesome. Like, come and do this, you know.
No, that's something that, I mean, I feel that poets could try doing a little more in terms of the performances, like something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I love, like, jazz with poetry, but I'm like, we can do other stuff, you know? I get not wanting to, like, do poetry during metal, you know?
Well, this is the thing, is I did try, I mean, you have a couple poems referencing extreme metal in your book. One of which it references Mayhem, which is like possibly the most cursed band of all time.
Yeah, Mayhem and Varg from Burzum.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. No, I mean it's. But they. You know.
Yeah.
But I mean, and then Mayhem is still recording without Varg.
Yeah. Well.
And then the other members who died.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should probably kick that person out of the band if they kill your guitarist. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Euronymous also was running the label, so that was kind of another problem for a lot of other people besides the band members.
I mean, yeah, that whole second wave of black metal is such a fascinating history. And I'm a huge metalhead. I'm not even a big black metal guy. I like death metal. But you can't help. It's just such a good story.
It is.
Just like 100 of these like weird kids in Norway getting together and doing burning churches.
Well, they also kind of, I mean, it kind of spun off from, what is it? I mean, what happened was, you had Venom doing black metal.
Right.
But then you had, I'm not sure where they're from. There was a band that started doing, they did a couple albums, like 3 albums, and 2 of them are about like the life of a Viking.
Bathory?
Bathory, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like a huge influence in that, and I think everyone kind of went into like Odin worship, kind of.
Yeah. Well, there's like, I've noticed there's those two strains.
Or they
like,
call it Wotan, I think, because yeah. that makes it scarier or something. I don't
yeah,
know.
It's so silly. I recently saw a black metal show at High Watermark, a venue I love, with my partner, and I like learned it was black metal. I went like, oh no, you know, like, it just wasn't great because it's just like, it's grown men in corpse paint after a while. And there's,
yeah.
and there's something about someone trying to be scary that makes it so like, just funny. Like it's already funny. It's like how teenage boy being like, I know I'm serious, you know, I'm serious. And it's like, yeah. But like that, I don't know. I love metal and like, I am a huge metalhead and like we were saying earlier in the show, I like it when people like write me a poem about metal, you know. And I was like, I had a DIY moment of like, if no one's gonna write a poem about black metal, I'm gonna write a poem about black metal, and it's gonna be short, and it's gonna be concise, and it's gonna be like have like a really, really like morbid sense of humor to honor
yes.
this genre. Like you have to, you know, we're talking about people who used a crime scene as like a cover for one of their records. Like these
yeah.
people are not precious about anything. And it's just fascinating stuff. Could fill books with that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, I was just thinking like, how do you do a, like you could write a poem that has like a jazz kind of feel to it or like, you know, rhythm to it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how you write a poem that has blast beat rhythm to
yeah.
it. I was just thinking about that the other day because I actually did do like, I did some poems that were like death metal and they were like, but it was all about the vocals.
Yeah.
So it was like, there was like one, it was like, Facebook of Death.
Yeah, right.
And then there was other ones that are like, I'm going to have, I don't remember them very well, but it would be like, the bird's mass between the trees.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
I mean, I don't even know if that works for black metal, but I kind of felt it was.
I think, yeah, I don't know.
But the thing is, I think the rhythm being of blast beats is like, I don't know if anyone's pulled that off yet. How would you do that?
I think
it would be like Ginsberg on steroids?
Yeah, I guess. I'm thinking immediately of either like just one word lines that just go like that to give that like...
But that's a visual. I'm
yeah,
thinking like in terms of auditory.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like visual, you're right. I mean, that's one... Yeah.
Or like short staccato phrases.
Yeah.
Pretty Scandinavian like bass, you know, like... You know, but like the thing with... Yeah, there's so much poetry based on jazz that's just flowy and rhythmic and it makes sense, but I don't know. I think there's like, oh my gosh, who is it? The poet AI.
Yeah.
She has a collection of all of her books are good. She has a collection called Vice and like, those poems are gnarly, bro.
Is it like, about the, is it about like, I mean, it's just about Vice, right?
It's like all, they're all historical narrative poems. So they're
okay.
all from like, either about a historical event or from the perspective, like she has one from the perspective of Trotsky when he was exiled to Mexico.
Okay.
And like, but the imagery in it is just brutal. Like it's brutal stuff, you know, like Bolaño's poetry is the same. A lot of like, just really ugly. I think that's the closest we can get. I don't know. A lot of metal like poets are, I think they're poets. It's a Freudian slip, but they are, you know, like they,
some of them
it's just like death and gore and stuff.
Well, I mean, I have never read Dead's lyrics at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I would wonder maybe he was pretty good. I mean, I haven't actually heard him.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what got recorded that he sang on.
He
was dead before
the record. Yeah.
That also killed the rest of the
right, exactly. It's so ironic because I think that the bass playing that Varg did on that record is still on that record with the guitar playing that Euronymous did on that record.
Yeah.
So you have the murderer victim and the murderer playing on the same record. And
yeah,
just like,
it's nuts.
That's, like I said before, that's like a poem unto itself. Like,
no, it is.
That's amazing.
And if you pick up Dog Dow by Colin Keating out there, is it in Powell's right now or not?
No, I'm talking to Kevin right now.
Okay, cool. But yeah, like they should. But
it's on Amazon. It's on Abe Books. You can find it online. You can follow me on Instagram.
You'll be able to find the poem where the black metal traffic jam.
Black metal traffic jam.
Which references the events of the mayhem.
Yeah.
Of mayhem.
The mayhem in the mayhem. Yeah.
Mayhem in mayhem.
Yeah.
I guess we covered the black metal part.
Yeah, we really did.
The metal part.
The metal part.
So you're more of a death metal.
I like all of it. If it's good, it's good.
Yeah. You know? No, I kind of...
I think black metal is... Well, I don't know.
It depends.
It really... It always does. Like, it's... I think death metal is more reliable for me because... it's just 4-minute songs about people murdering other people. Like, I don't know. I like the vocal style more. I like the instrumentals. I'm not such a huge fan of the screeching. I like the, like, kind of stuff.
I have to say, it's a lot easier to do this kind of voice than that.
Yeah. They're like, kind of stuff. Like,
there's a reason those bands don't tour very much.
Yeah, no, I saw Death Heaven they mix black metal with like shoegaze and stuff. And I saw their lead singer and like, he started singing that like, stuff like, and he was so loud. Like, he was so loud.
Kind of impressive.
He didn't even need a microphone. It was that Wonder Ballroom. It was like, however many, that's 500, 600 people there. Yeah. And like, I went to the back to get a beer, and like, he's hitting the back of a room. Like, you can hear those vocals, and that's not usually the case with black metal. Those vocals are like buried under the guitars usually, but yeah, I don't know. There's a really good metal scene here in Portland too, so good punk scene too. But I have such a soft spot for it. I don't know. It's so cool.
Well, do you want to read another poem?
Sure. Yeah.
How
are we doing on time?
Probably got 5 to 10 minutes.
All right, cool. I'm going to read a section from Smoking at Disneyland, the book that's coming out.
Yeah, we got to have some smoking.
We got to have some of that new content. And the beautiful streetcar. Thanks, streetcar. I wrote this so that there is a poem in the book called Smoking at Disneyland. It's like the dead center of the book. To date, the longest poem I've ever written. It's like three full types. It's a prose poem. It's like three full pages. So I'm only going to read one section of it.
Okay.
But I was really interested in the metaphor and the idea of like the smoking sections at Disneyland. You know, because they used to... Have you been to Disneyland?
No.
Yeah.
I should, but I don't.
It's so weird. Like, it's super fun, but it's weird. But I remember like growing up in the 90s and going with my family, they'd have smoking sections, and it was just such an interesting image of just like people having a smoke around all this sort of like family fun, artificial stuff, you know what I mean? And then in 2000, I want to say 15, in like Anaheim, they phased all that out. I was thinking about that idea and that image about like something that's so family friendly and something that's so family not friend unfriendly, you know. So this is Smoking at Disneyland 3. They used to hand edit cigarettes out of pictures of Walt Disney. He smoked 3 packs of Lucky Strikes a day before dying of lung cancer in 1966. Dozens of photos show him with a 2-fingered point, cigarette missing, which later became the approved hand signal to help guests with directions at Disneyland parks. Once his truth came out about the pictures, no one really cared. Disneyland banned smoking in all of its parks in 2019, and by converting the remaining smoking section into a new Star Wars-themed land, gently rewrote history. I think most art about Disney is too heavy-handed. I was never impressed by Banksy's fake park, or seeing the mouse's cartoon head on a stake, or Disney dollars graffitied with anarchist slogans. The symbolism suggested Disney was an entity that could be fought, that its aims of cultural omnipotence could be somehow challenged. The true incursion is into memory itself, into how memory can be bent and reformed to serve its current interest. A cigarette disappears, a kingdom is born. These are the hidden histories that handicap time. Now I see those clumps of smokers like pink-lit vultures near Frontierland's fake red rocks. They wore Zip-Osh jean shorts and listened to Slipknot and mariachi music on tiny plastic radios. Strangers at a kid's birthday party. Walt was very careful not to smoke around children. In a few of the photos, you can see a cloud of unmoored smoke above Walt's head, an emanation from nowhere, frozen in its impatience to dissolve.
Yeah. What did you think of the... there's a Sonic Youth album. Mm-hmm. Do you know about this?
Which
it's a, I mean, I know of it's Sonic a cover Youth. It's a cover of is it Sister or is it it's like around there's Evol, there's Sister, and then there's Daydream Nation. I think it's Sister, where they had a photo of from Disneyland, and then they put a little circle spiraling out, mm-hmm. like it was mind control. Uh-huh. And they were forced to take it off the cover.
Sure, yeah.
But, I mean, I guess that kind of goes into your pile of art that doesn't encapsulate Disney.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably comes from a place where that art was still potent, you know?
It's potent enough for them to get sued.
Right, exactly. I mean, Disney is the most litigious company in the history of any corporation. Like, it's insane. I tried looking for the poem, research for the book. I was like, how many lawsuits has Disney been involved in? And even Google was like, dude, we don't know. Like, we can't tell you. Like, but it's in the thousands, if not tens of thousands.
Oh, wow.
Lawsuits. Like, they sue everybody.
That makes sense.
I got a cease and desist letter, or not a cease and desist, but I was during the pandemic, I was torrenting, illegally downloading The Mandalorian. They said, and like, Viacom. So
none of this happened.
None of this happened, though. Yeah, in Minecraft.
Don't, Mickey. Yeah. Don't.
Don't do it.
Well, yeah, stop listening right now.
Yeah, but anyway,
Mickey Mouse. Stop listening.
The Colin figure got this figure saying, like, you know, they're on that stuff. I think I don't know. Hmm. I think I see that in the poem too. It's like the true incursion is into memory. Which I remember it was like. I remember writing that line and being like, oh, yeah, you know, that's so true. Because it's like, it's that postmodern idea of like, you don't change your environment anymore. The culture changes, or you don't change culture. Culture changes you.
Yeah.
You know, and Disney has been an entity for now over 100 years, like, and has completely changed the fabric of reality, literally, you know. And you see like two circles above a head immediately, that, you know, the same way that if you see the golden arches, you're like, oh, you know, like, and that's, you know, Deleuze and both Deleuze and Foucault talk about this, the real insidious fascism and authoritarianism is that of the mind, the psychological stuff, like the desire to be led, the desire to be controlled. And that's, so many people have that. I have that. We have that.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's like, oh, it'd be so much easier if somebody told me what to do, what to consume, what to look at.
Yeah. That said, I'm probably more controlled by Toho than Disney.
Well, that's totally true.
And by the way, when you were saying that Disney is the most litigious company, I was like, that was the one company I was thinking of.
Yeah. Because
they're really on it now. They didn't always do that, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
they lost some copyrights and they got really mad later.
Yeah, I just think it's pretty absurd that, like, you have a corporation, a cultural production corporation that is so infiltrated our lives in so many ways, good and bad, and we're not even allowed to, like, talk about it, you know? Like, it's we're not even allowed to make art about it or just talk about it.
And that's not how, like, things were in the Middle Ages or even later. I mean, what is it? Canterbury Tales. A lot of that is very much like Boccaccio.
Yeah, I mean, Shakespeare stole all of his plots. You know, like, and it's not to say you should wholesale theft, but this idea of, like, copyright is fairly new to art. And take an album like Beastie Boys, you know, Paul's Boutique, would not be able to make that record.
Oh, no.
Absolutely not.
And the whole thing about, what is it? Like, 3 feet high and rising.
Right, yeah. Those samples you would not be able to clear.
Well, or they,
you
would be, they got sued they because, got, yeah. because like it wasn't available until like maybe this year to download for a while, partially because of the label, but also, what is it, the Turtles sued them because they sample the Turtles song for transmitting live from Mars.
Yeah.
Which is basically a French language thing over a Turtles riff.
Yeah.
And it's like, that wasn't a hit. Why are you suing for this much money?
Right. Well, it seems to, just my personal philosophy, goes against how creativity works. Like, creativity is anarchic. Like, it does not care about who owns the thing. Like, look, if you're going to do a complete copy of somebody, yeah, I can see
they're,
why.
Yeah, they're a labor.
Yeah, I totally get that. But then you have an artist like Andy Warhol. That was his whole thing. Here's me reproducing this image over and over and over again. Kind of
point, with slight differences.
Yeah, to point to a lot of like these, to how culture is produced and reproduced, you know, and represented like over and over and over and over again. And I feel like, I don't know. All the cool kids are making art about that stuff. Like, all the coolest stuff in 21st century and late 20th century art, like hip-hop and graffiti and collage novels and a lot of cool poetry, is all just, like, completely, you know, tipping that sacred cow over. Just being like, we're just going to take what we want.
Mixing everything up. And like, the thing is, this actually happened in the past, but it didn't quite happen exactly the same way, which is fun.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
but like...
It's like, but if somebody like wants to take my book, take lines from... And I've had friends and poets who have done this, take lines from my poems, use it as an inspiration for new poems, or collage my book together, or even if they wanted to photocopy, you know, my poems and just... But, you know, like, I don't care about that stuff. I did not go into writing to make money or to, like, be a corporation, you know? Like, I think that's well, like, disgusting.
Well, actually, I mean, I think we're almost at the end of the show.
Sure, yeah.
But I have to say, that is an idea.
Yeah.
To become a corporation. That'd be, like, the more Andy Warhol step, to become the poetry corporation.
Right, yeah. Like the Poetry Corporation, totally. Yeah, this is Poetry LLC. Yeah, I actually own the copyright.
The next show is going to be, you know, next Talking Earth is not going to be Talking Earth. It's going to be the Poetry
Corporation. Yeah, they'll have heard. They'll have taken over now.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Let's wait and see.
Grab your books while you can.
Yeah, I'm getting a phone call now.
We got to stop.
It's
Cut deep. It.
You have been listening to Talking Earth, please enjoy us before we shut down.
Yeah.
This is, you've been listening to KBO Portland. I've had Colin Keating on, his book, Dog Dow, as well as the new book coming out soon, whose name I spaced because apparently I'm
Smoking
a corporation. Smoking in
Disneyland.
No wonder I spaced it because memory is now owned by Disney.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone have a good night. Good luck with all
good
of
night,
that.
Yeah.